Everyone, I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE. It's my pleasure to welcome you all this evening to the London School of Economics. I'm very pleased to welcome this evening Her Excellency Mrs. Suzanne Mubarak, Egypt's First Lady and the wife of Hosni Mubarak, president since 1981. She has proved to be a highly popular First Lady, committed to many causes. She is here this evening to talk about the position of women in society and particularly their role in promoting peace. The talk will be followed by a question and answer session. Mrs. Mubarak has a long association with the United Kingdom. Her father, an Egyptian doctor, trained at the Cardiff Royal Infirmary, where he met her mother, a nurse from Pontypridd. Although perhaps not a typical Welsh girl, I apologize for this disruption. But we must push on. I was saying, although perhaps not a typical Welsh girl, as a child she visited Wales every year, and when she was about 8 years old, lived with her grandparents and went to school in Wales. The family have two sons with English nicknames, Alan and Jimmy. Mrs. Mubarak was educated in Egypt, where she studied political science and later took a master's degree in the sociology of education at the American University in Cairo, from which she was later also given an honorary doctorate. So I'm pleased to welcome a fellow sociologist here today, because I'm a sociologist too, in case you didn't know. Mrs. Mubarak's work at the American University in Cairo on primary school education reflected many of the issues that she was later to devote much of her time to. She was the founder and chair of the Integrated Care Society, established in 1977, an organization with the objective of providing social, cultural, and health care to school children. One of the activities of the Integrated Care Society is the establishment of children's libraries throughout Egypt. She also launched in 1991 a campaign on Reading for All that has stimulated a national movement focused on young and adult readers. Mrs. Mubarak is also chair of the Honorary Committee on Resurrecting the Alexandria Library, which has been rebuilt by the Egyptian government with support from UNESCO. It is now reopened after a gap of 1,600 years. Not a long time, really, in human history, and contains a cultural complex with libraries, museums, exhibition areas, educational centers, and so on. However, it is on the role of women in society, in particular in promoting peace, that she is here to talk today. Egypt is a country with a tradition of activists and writers who have fought for women's rights, as I'm sure Mrs. Mubarak will agree. The centennial anniversary of Kazim Amin's famous publication, Women's Emancipation, was celebrated in 1999. Mrs. Mubarak has been involved with these issues for many years. In 1985, she headed the Egyptian delegation in the United Nations World Conference in Nairobi, which reviewed and appraised the achievements of the United Nations Decade for Women. Mrs. Mubarak has recently complained about the image of Arab women in the non-Arab world. After September 11, she has said, Arab women have been much represented. The focus has been on the poorest and on the burqa, yet this is far from the whole picture. Mrs. Mubarak recently set up Women for Peace Initiative. Women for Peace believes that women have a central role to play in advocating peace, in defending peace, in promoting peace, and in participating in its realization. And as we were saying just before this occasion, the participation of women in democracy is absolutely central. No functioning democracy can work without the full emancipation and participation of women. These aims seem particularly relevant in the wake of the conflict in Iraq, and it is to discuss this and many related issues that we welcome Mrs. Mubarak to the LSE to speak this evening. And I'd ask you to give her a particularly warm LSE welcome. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Professor Giddens, for your very kind introduction. It is a privilege to be invited to share some thoughts with you at the world-famous LSE, a school that has been a bastion of free thinking and forward ideas, and a model of high intellectual integrity. For over 100 years, LSE has been not just a center of excellence, but also the crucible of the new social sciences, the place where a profound humanism confronted both scientific rigor and an imperfect world. Its thinking has had profound impact on political actions. From the days of the Fabian Society to those of New Labour, the LSE has marked British and world political currents and has become a symbol for the application of analysis to political, economic, and social action to improve the human condition. The school has had many distinguished professors from the developing world and has been concerned with the issues of development. Efficiency and equality, as much as economics and education, have been at the center of the school's concerns. These are timeless concerns. We all share them and bring our different perspectives and experiences to discussing them. For myself, an Egyptian who has devoted a large part of her life to public service for education, gender equality, and development, these are themes that resonate with a compelling immediacy, themes that echo throughout the reflections that I would like to share with you today. We live in a world of plenty, of dazzling scientific advances and technological breakthroughs that promise great hope for humanity. Yet too many people are being left behind. This disregard of the needs of some amid an unprecedented pace of global change has produced environments of inequality that breed alienation and desperation. Some may dismiss these human situations as sad, but too distant to matter. But if there is one thing recent history has taught, it is that when one country suffers the devastation of famine, desperation, lawlessness, and loss of hope, that level of suffering is rarely contained within geographic or economic boundaries. Few would have imagined that the new millennium would see so much of humanity still blighted by insecurity stemming from violent conflict, abject poverty, poor health, and illiteracy. Few would have thought that universally enshrined political ideas and the core values of tolerance, justice, equality, respect for the other, and the right to self-determination would still be denied to so many. Fewer still would have expected to see the credibility of international legitimacy and legality reach such a low ebb, leaving the international community troubled, confused, and uncertain. Indeed, these are truly paradoxical times. Genuine peace, security, and development must be explored by thinking across boundaries, national, ideological, cultural, and disciplinary. Without political stability and peace, human welfare will be jeopardized. It is quite easy to fall into the trap of a dangerously simplistic view of peace and security, one that defines them in terms of strength and military might. Indeed, peace has been elusive to mankind so far, but it is possible to achieve. It can exist, and it must be radically redefined. Clearly, an environment where might is seen as right is not conducive to peace or confidence building. A state of affairs where legality is determined in the eye of the beholder is a prescription for anarchy. The application of one standard for one people and of a completely different standard for another breeds frustration and instability. Two recent examples of this spring to mind. Many in the world were seriously troubled when ancient statues were demolished by the Taliban in Afghanistan, while the same degree of concern was not displayed when the world's heritage was plundered in Iraq after the war. Also, only some countries are being chastised for their perceived ownership of weapons of mass destruction, while others, who have well-known stockpiles of these weapons, are not admonished. Most importantly, as much as the promotion of democracy within states has become an ultimate goal to be attained, democracy among states is equally important to fostering a culture of peace. It is difficult to promote ideas of participation and decision-making inside the country while the same principles are ignored at international level. The call for the democratization of the decision-making process in international organizations is urgent and one that can no longer go unheeded. Today, international peace and order has been gravely impaired. A serious healing process is in order to restore harmony to the world political body and to ensure that the we, the people, in the Charter of the United Nations remains the capital we, a strong, united we that enhances collective action and restores trust to the system. What is needed is a soul-searching exercise and a genuine dialogue, not a cosmetic surgery or an attempt at whitewashing. At the very least, we must stop and realize that warfare, under any name, is reckless, irrational, and inexcusable. The scourge of war dislocates societies, disperses people, causes environmental degradation, and creates vicious cycles of destruction, poverty, and misery. As UNICEF's executive director told the United Nations in January, we must recognize that when it comes to the suffering of children in conflict, all of us are accountable. I'm not a politician. I have always been far more concerned with people than with power. But when policies are made, let me urge again and again that people are placed at their center. That principle must be paramount, especially in the serious decision any country can make, determination to go to war. Peace and security will not be achieved through confrontation, but through the ongoing, ceaseless pursuit of understanding on all sides. We have been forced to realize in the most horrific of ways that peace is not a matter of circumstance or even politics, but requires, in the words of UNESCO's constitution, the intellectual and moral solidarity of mankind. Meanwhile, despite frequent political declarations of commitment to peace, we find that military spending today is 14 times the total flow of official development assistance. The former Secretary General of the United Nations, Boutros Ghali, said in the 1992 Agenda for Peace that global defense expenditure at the end of the previous decade had approached $1 trillion a year, or $2 million per minute. Surely, this does not reflect well on the priorities of the rich and powerful segments of humanity to see such patterns of spending at a time when there is no doubt that half the human family lives a marginalized and highly vulnerable existence. The wealthy nations of the world have an obligation to do more to spread the benefits of globalization so that it reaches the underdeveloped world. It is against these very challenges that those who would promote our common humanity must, with institutions like yours, focus on education and culture as the keys to bridging the chasm between the present we endure and the future we seek. It is indeed remarkable that for nearly every kind of human insecurity, education can have a preventive role, a constructive contribution to make. It is first and foremost through education that the values of nonviolence, tolerance, democracy, solidarity, and justice, which are the very essence of peace, can be passed on to individuals at a very early age. Education should promote open-mindedness, which is vital in a world where the interdependence of nations and peoples and their interactions are growing in importance day by day. The task is not to reject what is different, but to explain and understand it. If we have failed to cross the divide, to realize that diversity is not a synonym of adversary, and in doing so, we have built walls rather than tearing them down, it does not mean that the new generation cannot transform those walls into bridges and walk across them. Lasting peace cannot be constructed around a conference table unless it is deeply rooted in the minds of men. Nor can it be merely a matter of signing treaties, as history has made only too plain. It must be founded in the long term on the values handed down to young people by their families, teachers and social players, decision makers, and democratically elected representatives. Peace means building up. It cannot be invented from scratch, but it is built up from day to day. It is a task that requires a long-term view and a daily struggle at individual, national, and international levels. To that end, education for citizenship, for participation, and for tolerance is vital. Every individual should be trained in respect for human rights and in understanding the value of the transfer and sharing of knowledge between the various cultures and societies, because it is through the contact of minds that positive peace may emerge. And this is where the role of an educational institution such as your esteemed school has an instrumental role to play. It is my hope that new and existing links between universities, research centers, and professional legal bodies in the developed and developing world could be promoted. Ladies and gentlemen, today another major force for the world change is civil society. Women have emerged as influential players in this field, making up the majority of civil society volunteers and activists worldwide. New networks are linking grassroots organizations to the political process, diversifying the voices heard in the corridors of power. New partnerships across governmental, non-governmental, and corporate lines are making major advances by focusing on the issues that concern them rather than the distances that divide them. Through these partnerships, civil society members are finding out how their work can indeed make a positive contribution to the problems plaguing their societies, how they can actually make a difference. In developing countries, NGOs are often better and more cost-effective than governments at meeting the needs of citizens, creating opportunities for them and protecting them from the new vulnerabilities of globalization. Their impact can be gauged by their increasing share of resources and by the impressive list of their achievements. A vibrant NGO community is now being counted on to advocate for human development and maintain pressure on national governments, international agencies, and corporations to live up to their commitments and to protect environmental standards and human rights. Having become development catalysts, advocacy tools, and invaluable supports to the social safety net all at once, civil society agencies are undertaking very important work in such vital areas as the promotion of education, the alleviation of poverty, and the backing of peace-building activities worldwide. In Egypt, we have realized that women need to be more involved in the peace and security activities of the world. Given women's disproportionate suffering in times of war and armed conflict, their traditionally limited role in the area of peace advocacy, promotion, and preservation appears to be unjust. It is against this background that we launched the Women for Peace movement at an international women's peace conference in last September. Leading figures from all over the world came together at Sharm el-Sheikh to express a new and profound sense of solidarity that stems from a common concern to promote peace as essential to the protection, improvement, and enrichment of the quality of life of all our peoples. This solidarity transcended differences of religion, ethnicity, and nationality. Participants in our conference believe that women have a crucial central role to play in advocating, defending, and participating in the realization of peace, as well as in the reconstruction and rehabilitation activities that follow armed conflict. They urge women to work alongside men to find sustainable ways to foster a culture of peace, tolerance, and human security. And here I would like to offer you a few notable quotations from prominent personalities who attended the conference, which show how these women fervently believed in our cause. Mrs. Mary McAleese, the President of Ireland, said, "It is my strong belief that there is a requirement for a global response to conflict. Women, as half the citizens of our planet, have an undeniable stake in its future and the right to insist on having a central role in such a global response." The First Lady of Ghana, Mrs. Nana Rawlings, said, "We must appeal to the sensitivity and conscience of all women of the world to pause for a moment and say, I want to live on this world in peace. I am saying that we should come together and fight for that peace." The First Lady of Tunisia, Laila Ben Ali, said, There is a necessity to unite all efforts to establish a culture of peace and solidarity in the minds of people, a task that women have a great deal to contribute to. And the words of Baroness Odeen, member of the United Kingdom House of Lords, and I quote again, "Let us demand our right to be at the highest table of world politics. Let us fight for our responsibility to bring balance to this dangerously skewed world. Where there is hatred and loathing, let us seek courage and call for peace and conciliation. Where there are cries of mothers and children, let us chant for hope. Where there is pain, let us bring consolidation and justice to the victims. I believe this is not asking for too much," unquote. The movement we launched urges all women groups, associations, and organizations to join in. We intend to utilize it as a platform for making silent voices heard, a forum for dialogue and information sharing, a means of building alliances and a strategic avenue for enhancing the role and visibility of women as active partners in the elaboration of international policies and action for peace. Our efforts also came in response to the Security Council Resolution 1325, which calls for increased participation of women in the prevention and resolution of conflicts, in peace building, and in post-conflict reconstruction efforts. The conference was the first stage in the longer process of formulating and institutionalizing a global women's peace movement. Its mission is to find realistic and unconventional methods to mobilize efforts and resources of women's peace organizations and women peace leaders from around the world to create a platform for collective action. The subsequent conference to be held in the year 2004 will provide the opportunity to reach a common framework and agreement on methods and mechanisms for launching the next phase of the campaign for world peace through the collective strength of diverse women's organizations. The meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh reinforced our belief that we, women of the world, have a message to deliver, a message to be heard worldwide, that we, as women, as mothers, want to pass on to our children a world that offers the promise of peace, development, and stability. The 2004 conference will be held at the Bibliotheca Alexandrina, one of the world's finest centers of learning and innovation, and a source of pride for all Egyptians. At a time of global uncertainty, Egypt has come forward with a major cultural complex that preserves the legacy of the past as it looks to the future, a future of peace and mutual respect, of learning and understanding, of promise and opportunity. So the choice of the venue is not accidental. The library promotes rationality and civility in discourse. It calls to the better angles of our nature at a time where conflict and suspicion need to be replaced by mutual respect and understanding and a dialogue between cultures and individuals. Yet this is no philosophical debating society. Yes, the library does have eminent scholarly activities, but it is also devoted to the needs of societies of today and tomorrow. Its activities address the profound issues that underlie the problems of the world today. It addresses the very foundations of long-term peace, peace based on equity and justice, and on the participation of all in the shaping of their own destinies. Already in the last year, I would just like to share with you this, I think it's very important, about the activities of the library. It shows this profound commitment to bring together all the best minds of the world with all the relevant social actors to address the issues of peace and development and the rights of men and women everywhere. And I'll just give you a few examples of what has taken place in the library since its just 1 year since its birth. The library hosted a major international conference on biotechnology and sustainable development, Voices from the South and North, in March 2002. The conference created the space for the voices of developing countries and those of women to be heard. And the message that came out clearly was that special efforts must be launched to ensure that the new sciences address the needs of the many rather than being channeled to add to the luxuries of the few. Indeed, that if science, currently dominated by the rich industrialized countries, is harnessed to the needs of the 80% of humanity, that live in the developing world, it would help build bridges of understanding and collaboration and promote peaceful cooperation rather than confrontation. Women were prominent in that event and in shaping its message of peace and understanding. But beyond sharing of the fruits of science and technology, there are ethical questions to be addressed. And this is why the library organized another major conference on ethics and social responsibilities of science and technology. This major international event addressed the issues of governance and participation of society in making the social choices that guide how science is to be practiced and how technology will be deployed in the world. It is important that this conference was strongly imbued with the need to harness the possibilities of science and technology for the benefit of all of humanity, especially the disadvantaged, and for the cause of peace rather than promoting the destructive efficiency of weapons. The library was also the venue for the first ever Youth Employment Summit, where almost 2,000 persons from 140 countries attended this event. It was wonderful to see these young people from all over the world, young boys and girls, working together, imbued with the spirit of collaboration and seeking to learn from each other's experiences. The youth at the summit were engaged in finding ways to achieve a number of ambitious goals in the area of in the area of employability, employment creation, equity, entrepreneurship, and empowerment. Indeed, unemployed youth, deprived of hope and opportunities, become a political and, as we know, a political and social time bomb. Peace demands attention to such problems, which also represent an enormous waste of talent and capabilities. I have given these examples to make a point that peace is not just something that is negotiated at the end of the war or conflict, but it must be rooted in justice, equality, and freedom. It has to be anchored in the belief of men and women alike that they have a role to play and that the future is one of hope and possibilities and not of marginalization and exclusion. We hope the Women for Peace movement, the year 2004 conference, will meet the same success as Sharm el-Sheikh's meeting in bringing women closer to peace efforts worldwide and reinforcing our message for peace. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe I'll just have a sip of water. Nile water, yeah. Nothing like that. Ladies and gentlemen, anyone who has been monitoring the history of the Middle East knows how important peace and development are to the peoples of this region. Maybe you can just close the one. Let me start again, because this is an important part of my speech. Anyone who has been monitoring the history of the Middle East knows how important peace and development are to the peoples of this region. Today, two peoples in our region, the Palestinians and the Iraqis, are still awaiting an uncertain future. The Palestinian people have been longing for their freedom for too long. They have suffered tremendously under oppressive occupation, and their call for a just peace has not yet materialized. Nothing is as deeply embedded in the psyche of the Arab people as the suffering and injustice perpetrated against the Palestinian people. Why is the Arab-Israeli conflict, which constitutes the most serious threat to peace and stability in the region, not addressed with the same vigor as other issues? It is the answer to such questions, or unfortunately, the lack thereof, that is the reason why so many people in the Arab world are angry and frustrated. And this anger has fed extremism and violence. We need to re-inspire hope in the peace process, and to demonstrate to the Palestinians by deeds, not words, that there is truly a light at the end of the tunnel. We must recognize that there are no wars without casualties, and that these are usually the weakest and the most vulnerable groups in society that suffer. In Iraq, beyond the casualties, the suffering and the deaths, we have just witnessed the heritage of the world and the memory of a nation destroyed in a few moments of looting and vandalism, while concerned citizens around the world watched helpless to stop this enormous calamity. Most of us sit in our living rooms, sipping tea, maybe here in Britain, or having dinner somewhere else, watching the various media channels give grueling accounts of what is happening in areas of conflict and war, the most recent being in Iraq. We watch with mixed feelings, horror, anger, sympathy, and frustration. But do we really feel the trauma and pain the victims are suffering? Is it possible that people have to suffer war to appreciate the need for peace and to realize that the value of human life is the same regardless of whose side we may be on? The fact that millions of people rallied against war in every city of the world proves that this is thankfully not the answer. It is a cruel irony that those who suffer most are the ones who are most forgotten in the end. During a conflict, the wounded, the refugees, the widows, the orphans are the ones in need of aid and protection, just when these are the hardest to provide. When war ends, we celebrate the achievements of the negotiators or the victors. We applaud the fortitude of the returning soldiers. We mourn the dead. But what about those who survived? Strife flares in another part of the world. The cameras and aid agencies move on, and those at the center of the suffering, especially women and children, are left alone to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. And it is at that moment, when they turn to the future, that the world seems to turn its back on them. A strong message needs to emerge soon, that nothing is more in the interest of the world community than the renunciation of war. A genuine sense of universal responsibility must govern international relations. I wish that stopped. A strong message needs to emerge soon that nothing is more in the interest of the world community than the renunciation of war. A genuine sense of universal responsibility must govern international relations. Today, we are truly at a major crossroads in history. We are asking ourselves, is the world going to be led by fear and aggression, or will it be driven by diplomacy, morality, and peace? Will the revolving door of hatred and violence continue to spin, or can we stop this cycle and open new doors of trust and tolerance? In the wise words of the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, and I quote, "If war is the failure of diplomacy, then diplomacy, both bilateral and unilateral, is our first line of defense. We need to continue to talk to each other, listen to each other, and most of all, understand each other. We need to recognize as viable and legitimate those ideas or views that may seem foreign to us because of our own preconceptions. Belief in change and renewal is a defining characteristic of social progress and development. The genius and beauty of modern civilization should lie or lies in the synthesis and harmony of all people of various races, religions, and ethnicity. It lies in its inclusion of our common values and on the fact that what brings us together far exceeds what pulls us apart. Indeed, in preserving our different cultures, we celebrate the greatness and strength of our common humanity. We must ensure that the voices of the underrepresented, the excluded, and the marginalized are amplified rather than silenced or drowned out. Many of those are silenced before they even have a voice. Those are the voices of our children. We must give our children a chance. We must give peace and development a chance. The rapidly globalizing world is full of promise. Development can indeed reach the unreached, but this will require a dedication on our parts to universal ideals, a determination to wage peace, sensitivity to fellow humans, and a commitment to the cause of rationality, dialogue, learning, and understanding. In this age of uncertainty, it is time to rise to these challenges. Surely we can dream of a better world where peace and inclusion are the norm, not the exception. We must dare to dream, for dreams are the spark that ignites the flame of change. The London School of Economics is a wonderful venue to urge these timeless values. through spreading the power of knowledge elevated by humanistic ideals, yours and other similar institutions can be a driving force for the understanding and peace we so deeply need. Together, we can confront our shortcomings as we draw strength from our renewed commitment to creating a better world for all. Thank you.
Do, as I said at the beginning, have a certain amount of time for questions. There are roving mics going around the room. The First Lady has a fairly strict schedule, but I think we've got about 15 minutes or so. So would anyone like to ask the first question? I think I'll take some.
Yes.
You have to hold the mic sort of halfway down.
Hello, this is Yoon-Ju Lee from Korea, standing at SOAS. You mentioned the voice of the underrepresented, and I wanted to know that what has been the role of women leaders in filling the gap between the male leaders and public, especially women and children? Thank you.
Can you just repeat the last bit of it?
What has been the role of women leaders in filling the gap between male leaders and publics, especially women and children?
Filling the gap between leaders and the public.
And the women?
Yeah. Women leaders. It wasn't a very clear question, I don't think.
Well, as far as I understand the question, I think this is just what we are calling for. We are calling for more participation of women in all decision-making processes, not just concerning peace. We believe that women, and maybe I'm talking about our part of the world, that we need to have more women in decision-making process. We need to have women who make decisions, especially when it concerns their own lives, the lives of their family, the lives of community. And the more we get women included in decision-making process, I think we will definitely have a better world. Because it doesn't make sense that women are excluded from decision-making. They're just left out of the political process, left out of the economic decisions that are made, and everything that affects their life. I think they should have something to say about that, and they should be included to help, as you said, maybe if that was the question, to help the women and the children in society, if I got that.
Very good
right.
Answer, whatever the question was. There's a take you from the front. Can you take the microphone?
Yes. Let us pay homage to Comrade Walter Sisulu, the architect of apartheid, whether it's in South Africa or in Palestine. Okay, good. I can't buy a book, sociology book titled How to Address the First Lady from Alexandria with a Soul from the Coastal Village of Pontypridd. Madam, you rightly said about the destruction of Burmese Buddha despite the protest from strong protest from Sri Lanka or Japan. Could you please tell us about your personal opinion about the September 11th as well as this post-September 11th war, unlawful invasion and destruction of the whole civilization in Iraq? Because we think that women like you could do a lot, whether it is for the prevention of biological war against HIV or the political war which is being waged in the Middle East.
Thank you.
So
thank
what do you think that you could do?
I think we get the question.
The role of women.
I think we've got the
because we want the peace. We want to get peace from Palestine to Kashmir so that, as you rightly said, the youth from all over the world could come to Kashmir to celebrate irrespective of the religion. So here I think that in your religion, it is very difficult for the West, I don't know whether they deal politically or secretly, to deal with your religious leader. Here the bridge, as this lady rightly said, women could do a wonderful role in bridging the gap between the Western world and the modern Arab world. Thank you.
I think the First Lady considers that a statement rather than a question.
Yeah, I don't think there's a
Please, would you like to ask a question?
Get the question straight.
I would ask if you would keep questions fairly short because there isn't much time.
I'm Annette Lawson from the Women's National Commission, and I'm delighted to see you, Mrs. Mubarak, here. I participated in the Women for Peace Conference. you are, as the last speaker said, in a position to do an enormous amount of good. You already do. Many of us around the world, particularly in the United Kingdom and in the United States, are working right now to try and ensure that United Nations Resolution 1325, which insists on the participation of women both in the decision-making processes before war, well, all right, we've got beyond that in Iraq, but certainly in the post-conflict situation should be involved in all decision-making as well as having their special needs as victims recognized. It would be an enormous help, we think, if you would stand up and insist on 1325 being implemented in Iraq. Thank you.
Thank you. I can just answer by saying that I truly believe that women in Iraq now have to be, I mean, there is a huge untapped potentiality there. There are lots of educated women in Iraq. There are university professors, there are doctors, there are lawyers. Iraq is not a small village. Iraq is a whole nation with 20 million people. And I'm sure we can tap a few thousand women, not let alone a few million, that can be mobilized to work now for the reconstruction of their own country. And where civil society is concerned, whether we can identify certain NGOs that were already working there, whether we can create these groups to work at the grassroots, to work with women and children, and to work in the rebuilding of the society, I think it will be very important. And maybe we can work together, Annette, to see how we can get our message across to the United Nations again. Thank you.
I'll take the other one. Then I'll come to
Kate Ady, I represent Womankind, which works for women's, the status of women being improved in many countries. And having just come back from southern Iraq, I was struck by the fact that not a single women's organization is mobilized. And also, the UN is going to be frankly ignored, at least for the foreseeable future. So there's a major problem. And I also observe that those going in to facilitate reconstruction and the political organization of the country are all male-dominated organizations. The military, big business, and the high diplomats. And the people they're making contact with are traditional religious leaders, local heads of tribes, and the other traditional men. What would you be prepared to do to try and get educated Arab women who understand the situation and what needs to be done in order, as you said, to anchor peace and equality? What can you do? What ought you to do right now? Because it's no good passing high-minded UN resolutions.
In Egypt, we were discussing working with the Egyptian Red Crescent Society. And this is a society which the majority of members are women. And we were considering how we could form a group of women to go in the name of the Egyptian Red Crescent Society and to try and, as I said, to identify women's... I don't think there are many women organizations as such that had worked previously in Iraq, because I think all the services and all the work was done by the Ba'ath Party. And I don't think there was much for what we so-called civil society or having NGOs or people working in that kind of sense. So I think we have to either start getting that message across that the Iraqi women have to, and I'm sure they will, have to start formulating their own groups, their own associations, their own organizations, and maybe we can just help them along the path just to tell them how this can be achieved. But it has to be, I think, the responsibility of Iraqi women, but I think they just need the leadership. But the problem is, again, will they accept leadership coming from outside, even the women? I'm not sure. And even as Egyptians, I'm not sure even if they will accept us, even if I go with my group of members in the Egyptian Red Crescent, I don't know if they will accept Egyptians to go and tell them what they should be doing or what they can be doing. Very delicate issue, very sensitive issues, and we have to deal with it in that context. We have to be very careful of how we deal with such matters. But I think something has to be done. I think we just have to talk more and have maybe more meetings, more brainstorming sessions to see how is the best way we can deal with such issues.
War always wrong. I think early on you said in simple terms, war is wrong. If so, do you think war was wrong in Kuwait 10 years ago, in Palestine in 47, in our history, against Adolf Hitler? If war is sometimes right, when is war right?
Personally, I don't think war is ever right, but that's my personal opinion. I may be wrong. I'm not a historian. I have not gone to the details of all the world wars and what happened in Europe or the rest of the world, but definitely I think that war is wrong. War in Kuwait was definitely wrong, uncalled for, no reason for that. And I don't want to go into too much detail about what I think war on Iraq was. As I said, I'm not a politician. I don't want to get myself into political problems. But I'm talking from the humanities. I don't think it is right to go and destroy cities, demolish homes, attack refugee camps, kill innocent children and women. If you saw the pictures that we saw, not many were viewed on the Western media, but if you saw the Arab media, you'd see much more of the terrible waste of lives. And the picture that got me most was the mother who was killed with a baby in her arms that had his little, what you call it, the dummy in his mouth. I mean, these are scenes that one cannot really go to bed and have a good night after you see. So wrong, for me, war is wrong. Whether some wars lead to better circumstances or where some wars, as we say, are made in the name of liberating people or democracy or whatever we name it nowadays, I don't think it's right. But this is my personal opinion.
Can you stand up so people could hear you? Oh, no, you finished your, I think we must give other people a...
All wars, I said are wrong.
My name is Basil Yunus, MSc Finance Economics candidate at LSE. I just have a question regarding how severely will the recent currency devaluation in Egypt act as a barrier towards development, given that the Egyptian pound was almost devalued by 35% since January 2003?
The first part of the question, how was?
How severely will the recent currency devaluation act as a barrier towards development in Egypt?
Again, I'm not an economist, but as far as I know...
It's easier if you don't know.
I don't know what I am in the end, but I'm I'm a woman who have come here with a message of peace. I am one who is interested in development. My whole life has been dedicated to working for the poor, impoverished people, the excluded, the marginalized women and children. And this is why I think that we need peace. We need peace. We need a chance to develop. We need a chance to make people happier, to make people more secure, to all the beautiful concepts we're talking about, justice, equity, equality, freedom, determination, and even democracy needs peace. I think with every economic reform, you have some repercussions. With any change that you have, there's some kind of imbalance in the market, but it takes time to stabilize, and this is what we hope in Egypt will happen eventually. And I hope this is the right answer.
Can I take someone in the center here? Can I just say that we spent a lot of money on this lecture theater, but they seem to have forgotten that people have to speak in it, and the acoustics are not very good at all. So I'd ask everyone to speak up loudly, if you would, even though there is a microphone.
I'm May El-Daftari from Medical
Aid. Even louder, if you could.
I'm May El-Daftari from Medical Aid for Iraqi Children. I want to comment in answer to Kate's question about the Iraqi woman. From my visits to Iraq and my knowledge of the women, I mean, they are very qualified women, and they used to have really, I mean, they have to been working in the economy, and they did make an important segment of the working force. However, during the 12 years of sanctions and the economic problems they had and their responsibilities, they have been confined to their homes. And I think now it's the time where everybody should help them, and especially these women conferences, where they should really give a specific, you know, interest in how to help and reach the Iraqi woman and give her the chance of coming back to her healthy economical stand.
Yes, thank you. Well, as I said before, that we need to tap all these this wonderful human resource there, the educated women who are living in Iraq, and they have to be given a chance to explore themselves, their inner feelings, their hidden capabilities and creativity to participate in the reconstruction of the society. And maybe now what Iraq really needs as new perspectives, new voices, new institutions, and maybe if these institutions are democratic, then we will be hearing from Iraqi women and their voice will be heard at last.
I'm really sorry for everyone who wants to ask questions. This, I think, should be the last question. So maybe I'll just, please forgive me, everyone else who wanted to speak. Maybe you'd also speak up, though, again, if you would.
My name is Aranya Gohar. Hello, my name is Rania Gohar. I'm just, I thank you very much for your speech and your concern and paying everybody's attention to suffering, unemployment, youth frustration throughout the Middle East, especially in the Middle Eastern region, and women's role in promoting development and peace, and especially in fulfilling the gap between male decision making and their concern or having a closer look to the need of their population and children in societies. But do you think that women's enhanced role in such a decision-making process can fill this gap that the Middle Eastern youth is suffering from? Or do you think that the several events that have been occurring, let it be the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Iraqi issue, the 11th of September events, have provided a wake-up call to the Middle Eastern region to work with women's objective hand in hand?
Before September 11th, before the Iraqi war, I have to just share something with you that I think is very important. That in the year 2000, we had in Egypt the first Arab women's summit ever to be held in the history of the modern Arab world. We convened this conference where women from all over the Arab world came, first ladies, queens, princesses, intellectuals, professional women, artists, writers, authors, lawyers, NGO members, and we convened in Cairo and we discussed the important role of Arab women in the development of their societies. And I have to share with this audience that we were all, I mean, this was the first time to have, we meet in lots of conferences in the United Nations, we have conferences in Egypt discussing certain topics, we've been traveling the Arab world for different conferences, but we never had a conference this size where we shared our experience, where we planned that we should have more cooperation, more sharing of ideas, and working together to strengthen the role of Arab women in the Arab world. A year later, we had another summit held in Egypt, and just 2 months ago, we had the third summit held in Jordan. And we are continuing our work. We have established now, within the umbrella of the Arab League, this National Arab Women's Council. And this is a historic, I think, step forward, because I believe that without the support of the men in the Arab world, we would never have had the convening of this Arab summit. When I say summit, that every wife of head of state or king or emir, whoever is ruling the country, attended that summer. And we felt that this was a recognition from the Arab leaders that there's a political will for Arab women to come out into the open and to say, we are here, we are part of the society, and we have an important role to play on the local, national, and international level.
I'm afraid that we have to finish. Mrs. Mubarak was originally coming to the LSE a few weeks ago. She couldn't come because of events going on in the world. So we're doubly grateful that she came today, and I'd like to thank her for her speech delivered with verve and passion. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.